I would say one thing that Klaviyo did very well is we were very, very careful about like how and when we went up market. We probably could have gone more into mid-market and enterprise like a year or two before we did. And I'm actually really glad. I was leaning towards accelerating that and getting into the enterprise a little quicker. I think looking back, it's probably good that we didn't.
Behind the scenes, it was a small group of people that were doing everything.
Slow is smooth and smooth is fast.
I want to know how this insane growth actually happened.
What are you doing when no one's around, no one's looking? Are you just showing up and doing the minimum? Or are you approaching it like a pro? Be a student of the game.
Hello and welcome back to the GTM podcast. I always say it, but thank you for lending us your eardrums for the next 45 minutes. I know there's a million places you can go to level up. But here, you know, we try and speak through real stories from real vets, real operators that are in the trenches, have oftentimes seen zero to IPO, all the different flavors, and try and just dissect what worked, what didn't, and how shit really went down. And got a fantastic guest today. Super excited about this one. I am joined by Sean Marshall. Sean, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Scott. I'm excited to do this with you guys.
Yeah, man. Excited to dive in. And there's so much I want to cover. But before we get there, super quickly, for the listeners, quick Sean's background. So Sean's most recent operating role, he spent 4.5 years as the SVP of Global Sales at Klaviyo, obviously a darling in the e-commerce SaaS space. He helped scale the sales organization from 15 all the way to 300 people while growing ARR from 25 mil to 450 mil. So that's just an insane run. Offices in Boston, London, Sydney, and Sean oversaw it all, the entire revenue organization, which spanned sales, business development, sales operations, and sales engineering. And prior to Klaviyo, Sean served in enterprise sales roles at Localytics, Yammer, which was acquired by Microsoft, and SuccessFactors, which also had an IPO and acquisition by SAP for like $3.4 billion. Mm-hmm. And my understanding was you were one of the very first reps hired at Yammer to sell into like the Fortune 500, which is crazy, and were responsible for closing some of their biggest seven-figure contracts. And similar at SuccessFactors, you ran multiple business development teams as well as serving in different enterprise sales roles. So you've done a lot. You've done a lot. And now it's just cool with something we have in common. You kind of switched from operator to investor now and currently serving as the managing partner at Perkins Cove Partners. What else did I miss there, man? It's such an incredible background, and congrats on the multiple successful runs. I said this with another guest, Zach Lorick, who has just managed to pick winners every time. How did you manage to pick winners every time?
The truth is there's a lot of luck in there, especially early in my career. I would say SuccessFactors was probably right place, right time, and I got lucky. It turned out to be a really big company, went on to do some great things, but the network that I built there like paved the way for me to find Yammer and also taught me how to evaluate companies. So I'd say SuccessFactors, if I had to sum it up, was right place, right time. And there's always luck involved in some of this, right? But the network that I've built along the way really helped guide me in my career. And you could draw, you know, a clear line from like SuccessFactors to Yammer to Localytics to Klaviyo. And the network had a huge impact, you know, in my career. I will say, you asked me the one thing you missed. The one thing that you missed is new between when we booked this podcast and us now recording. I joined Asymmetric Capital as an executive in residence. So I'm basically advising a handful of their portfolio companies on go-to-market. So that's a new development, I'd say, in the last week.
Congrats. So you've got a lot of things going on. I believe you're also a scout at Kraft too. Is that still happening?
Yes. I've known, so a lot of the Kraft team worked at Yammer. David Sachs, one of the general partner of Kraft, was our CEO at Yammer.
And Brian Murray did.
Brian Murray, who's a good friend of mine. Yep. He runs the investment.
He's the man. We've had him on the pod. He's
Brian's awesome. Yeah. So they have a great crew over there. A lot of ex-operators that have built amazing companies. And I was pretty active as a scout for a couple of years, not so much anymore, but looking for pre-seed, like very early stage investments for them that would fit their portfolio.
Big fan of the team at Graf. They've been early supporters of GTM Fund, and I catch up with Brian quite a bit, and somehow he's always so calm, and he's like the COO at Graf and a founder of Cabal. And it's like, how are you so calm all the time? I need whatever he's having.
Yeah, he was always like that at Yammer as well. And that was early in his career as well. He was great in front of customers. He joined us in some of the biggest meetings, and he was really effective. He was sort of a Swiss Army knife at Yammer. Did a lot of different stuff.
Awesome. So what I wanted to jump right into is, so Klaviyo, like that run is just, it's a historic run. Has to be one of the fastest, you know, growth trajectories we've seen in SaaS. And I think from the outside looking in, one of the things that you did well was kind of move up into the enterprise through a PLG motion. And I think a lot of people are trying to figure that out. Mm-hmm. I think PLG had a moment. Everyone spun up some sort of self-serve PLG offering. And then some pulled back because they're like, no, we need to do enterprise. And that's different. But you guys seem to do it successfully where it felt like it was all one motion. So I would love to start there on, you know, AEs, founders, sales leaders that are listening to this. How do you move up into the enterprise in a PLG focused company?
People talk a lot about PLG, and it feels like a lot of companies try to use it as a sales tactic or like a go-to-market motion exclusively. At Klaviyo, it was really like the ethos of the company. Like every single thing that we did across the organization centered around how do we make it dead simple to buy our product and use our product, get up and running, get to value quickly. And when you start there and you form all your strategy off of that foundation, I think it becomes pretty obvious how difficult it is to build a product that lends itself well to very large companies and to small companies, all while trying to make it easy to install, set up, buy, low friction. Like it's difficult. It's very difficult. I would say one of the things, there's a lot of different things that we did, but I'd say one of the things that we did effectively going up market, we picked a wedge in our market that we felt like was a giant hole from a product standpoint in e-commerce. And when you're going up market, you're going up against people that are well known, Salesforce, Adobe, Oracle, and there's a bunch of, you know, very specific vendors that we used to compete with. And it's scary to make a change. Everything you say feels like you're trying to boil the ocean. It can take a lot to get people to even pick their head up to say, I'm interested in even having that conversation about making a switch. So we were very, very prescriptive in how we approach these big companies. Our advantage was we had a product that was dead simple to use. And it was dead simple to integrate with Shopify, BigCommerce, Salesforce Commerce Cloud, whatever you used. And that allowed us to really like lean in and ask them to try it so we could prove it out to them. And we would always pick a use case that we felt like we could get up and running quickly and just start there. And we knew that if we got the product in your hands and we solved this very specific use case that was high value, high ROI, but you weren't able to do it today, we knew that we could expand from there. So instead of coming in and selling Klaviyo and everything that we could do, we were really selling like a very, very specific use case that was simple, easy to understand, and we knew would drive a lot of revenue for that business. And we also knew that we could do it with a product that they could set up in an hour. You know, with the big companies, it'd be more involved. You know, it might take days of back and forth planning and logistically, how are we going to actually do this? But it wasn't a heavy lift. And so our whole goal was like, get it in your hands. We'll guide you through this. Give us a chance. If we show ourselves here, we guarantee you're going to want to go bigger. You're going to expand. And that's exactly what happened with a lot of these big customers.
I love that. So, you know, first it starts with the product. You need to have a very simple, intuitive product. Without that, you're going to be, you know, fighting an uphill battle, and then go very specific on the use case that you're attacking and not go after everything that, you know, the big incumbents are doing and fight that battle sort of one use case at a time. When you think of acquisition or like starting these conversations, was it typical that you know, a big company would go on the Klaviyo website and two or three people from X big company would start playing around with it and then you'd approach them? Or did you have enterprise reps that were going outbound to these big target accounts and trying to get them to sign up and use a free version? How did that typically work at the early stages?
Yeah. So we were very careful about how we approach these companies, because when you burn the bridge, it's over for a while. You can't go back to them for, you know, 6 months, maybe a year, maybe even longer, unless the person you reach out to has left the company. So we were very careful about like how we went at them and in what the story was. And we, you know, we didn't want to burn that bridge. We also knew that the majority of these customers bought through partners. They either outsourced the decision to a partner, to an agency, you know, it could be a dev shop, but they had a trusted resource that they would lean on for these types of technology decisions. You know, other people didn't necessarily outsource it to a partner, but they definitely involved a partner, and they would have this discussion with a partner. So we decided early on, like, we want to have a world-class partnerships program. And we spent a lot of time and resources in making sure we figure out exactly what it means to deliver an amazing experience to these partners, which were mostly agencies for the first few years. And that evolved into tech partners and even VCs down the line. But the majority of our like channel efforts were really through agencies. And so within enterprise, I think you have to think about it as a team sell. You know, you have a BDR, you have an AE, you have a CSM that eventually will get assigned to this customer if they buy. And you also have someone on your partner team, and then you have the actual partner. So the pod, you can call it a pod, whatever you want, has to be aligned in the whole journey. Like how you're going to go get that meeting, what story you're going to tell. Are you going to approach the client or the prospect with the partner on that call? Are you just going to try to sell the partner first to convince the client to take the meeting? You know, all of these things have to be considered. Whereas in SMB, most of the time, you can just, you know, you can run a very general outbound motion, sending personalized emails and making cold calls and try to get these meetings and just do your thing. So very different with enterprise. You don't want to mess it up. You don't want to burn the bridge. Not that you want to do that down market, but you have fewer trips to the plate. You have to maximize every trip, and you have to consider how to sell through partners. At least in our market, we had to.
I think that is a super often overlooked point when you start selling into the enterprise is, you know, you have this big initiative. We're like, we're going up market now. Here are our target accounts. You know, we've got lookalike customers like them. Let's go attack them all right away. And I saw this, you know, firsthand in my experience. I won't know names. We had a huge enterprise customer and we were going through another eval. We had lost the deal about 9 months before, and we're going through an eval again, and it was about to go to like a security audit. And I remember we looked at it and we're like, we haven't fixed the thing in our product that made us lose last time. Why are we? And we had, you know, 12 people around the table from our company, a lot of manpower, a lot of time and energy was spent on this. And it's like, we haven't done the thing and we're going to lose another 9 months if we go through with this. And so it's a super overlooked thing, I think, that these big companies, they'll give you one shot and then, you know, you're lucky if it comes back again in 9 months. How did you know that you were ready for some of these conversations?
So we had a chance early on, at least in my tenure, to go up market. I would say there was definitely an appetite internally because we had a few customers that were large, using the product, happy. So outside in, it looked like we were ready. We were a good fit. We're ready for the enterprise. Let's go. And, you know, lead volume would pick up a little bit. Partners would refer a lead here and there. The sales team would go get some meetings, have some good meetings. And there was enough signal there to feel like, okay, we're ready. I would say one thing that Klaviyo did very well is we were very, very careful about like how and when we went up market. We probably could have gone more into mid-market and enterprise like a year or two before we did. And I'm actually really glad. I was leaning towards accelerating that and getting into the enterprise a little quicker. I think looking back, it's probably good that we didn't. I have this conversation a lot with customers that, I mean, with portfolio companies I work with that want to start there. It's one thing to convince to be able to acquire an enterprise customer. It's very different to be able to deliver an enterprise experience to those customers. It doesn't matter how self-serve your product is. It's going to take a long time to get these types of customers to understand what it means to have a self-service help center experience or some AI chatbot that you're talking to get your questions answered. At the end of the day, if they have a problem at 2 a.m. and their executive is in Germany, they want to be able to talk to somebody. And we weren't there. We just didn't have that. So we looked out and we said, okay, what's the opportunity in the enterprise? Just like we would with any other market that we went after, we would put together a plan, put together a model, and try to understand what it's going to cost to deliver the experience that we want to deliver, which meant adding people, potentially opening up new offices. And then we had to try to compare the incremental revenue that we'd get to the cost and ask ourselves, is this a good business? Everything that we did, whether it was enter new segments or geographies or consider building products, was looked at as a new business. Different acquisition method, different customer success motion, different costs, and different revenue outcomes. So you almost have to like partition your business into like all of these cuts and be very, very methodical about how you make a decision and greenlight something. So we did that with enterprise. I think we had enough data and we had enough successful customers and finally got to the point where our product was there that we felt like we could sort of open the floodgates and like proactively go target them. And they're seeing a ton of traction right now. So they're doing really well up market.
I mean, that's a fantastic way to look at it and a good kind of thought experiment whenever you're entering new markets, building new product. Is like, if this was a standalone business and here are the metrics, here's our conversion rate, would we do this today and would we survive as a business? I feel like that's so simple, but not done often enough when people are moving so fast.
Yeah. I mean, it takes a lot of work and you have to have a really good understanding of how your business operates today and you need an understanding of how to allocate costs and how to evaluate markets. But it's a great exercise. I mean, I couldn't imagine running a business any other way. If you looked at this data, you know, in a spreadsheet and the data told you that the payback, you know, in this market was probably going to be north of 60 months for the first 2 years, you might say, that's not a business. Like, we don't want to go invest in that. We're not going to go do it. We're not going to enter this market. We're not going to build that product. You know, certain products are high margin, certain products are low margin. So I think we were good about that. We went deep on all the different dimensions of the business, whether it was segment, geography, or product.
Well, it's no wonder you ended up in venture with that mindset of, you know, evaluating every little thing as another business and seeing if you should invest in it. It's the same way, you know, any capital allocator is going to look at a company, and you're just doing the same thing, but for your internal, you know, business with the revenue you have, with the funds you've raised. Makes total sense. The other thing I wanted to circle back on, you briefly mentioned these enterprise pods that you set up. I would love for you to share a little bit more on kind of what the makeup of those pods were, how they worked together, and how that evolved over time.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, it was pretty simple. I've seen a lot of companies get very granular and have like a team of 3 or 4 people that do everything together throughout the whole journey. That wasn't us. Our goal when we set this up was to get pre and post sales on the exact same page. So connect the dots between the people that are trying to acquire customers, BDRs and sales, and solutions architects, our version of SEs, with the people that are going to service those customers. Early on, we didn't really have a good, you know, there wasn't a closed loop between all of these teams, and it creates problems down the line, right? So with enterprise, like one thing we just said, look, we're not going to go after thousands of customers. You know, these AEs are probably targeting 40, 50, of which 10 are high priority. Let's get very, very like strategic about how we're going to go get that meeting. Who do we know in those companies? Let's pull in the CSM early that would be assigned to this cohort of customers. And let's figure out like if we can use them pre-sale, like we can use them in the sale. Because again, you're trying to deliver this like experience when you pitch the prospect. It's not just, let me do some discovery, let me tell you what we can do, and then let's go through a sales process. We wanted to give them a sense of what it was like if you join the family. Like if you become a Klaviyo customer, I'm going to give you a sense of what it's going to feel like. So I'm going to introduce you now to your CSM, you know, if you decide to become a customer in 6 months, 9 months. And the CSM, their job is like, look, I work with a handful of companies that look just like you. I'm going to give you a sense of like what we've done for them. I know a little bit about your business. So let me just tease you with what I think we'll do together in this journey. I mean, that was the whole like idea behind us doing this. It was like connect the dots between pre and post sales, make sure the partner manager, because we had a whole partnerships team that was working, you know, trying to pull in partners to a lot of these deals, and just make sure that everybody in that group pod was aware of the customers, prospects that we were trying to go get. And the partnerships team was doing their job, making sure that they knew exactly what partners those prospects used, doing everything they can to sort of like grease the skids and allow us to either get in easily or like pitch on behalf of Klaviyo. And then just make sure the CSM had a chance to like show them the value of being a Klaviyo customer and what they were going to get with us. And that was just very different than the SMB team, because you can't really do that at scale. You have a team of 100 reps. You can't pull in CSMs all the time that are managing, you know, 200 customers.
Too much velocity, but I think that's a fantastic way of doing it. Not only do they can see the whole experience they're going to get, but also many times I find post-sales folks have a lot of great anecdotes that they can share, you know, up front. Like, hey, just behind the curtains, this is probably some of the hurdles that are going to come up. And it's almost like really rooted in reality throughout the whole process. And there's not a expectation gap where, you know, the AE promises a bunch of things and then they're fired off to someone else and they have to try and figure out how to deliver on all these promises. It's like a unified Klaviyo promise versus broken up into different, you know, segments of the process.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time training AEs on how to tell an effective story and trying to train them on all our customer stories. And what better way to do it than to have the CSM that's actually delivering the value and working with the client tell the story? So I think a CSM can be really effective in a sale, especially in an enterprise sale. And they have all that hands-on experience. I mean, they have a lot of credibility coming into the call. They're the ones that actually did all this stuff with the client.
Yeah, it gives you that extra layer of credibility. It's not, hey, we have done this as a company with XYZ. It's like, no, I was literally 2 months ago working with this client and here's how it went down. You know, I love that. Okay, shifting gears a little bit. So obviously that is an incredible run. And it's just kind of what everyone dreams of in SaaS is that run at Klaviyo. But you had a whole career before that. And we like to showcase stories from all times in someone's career. And, you know, we had a prep call before this and I asked one of the most impactful stories you've had. And it actually came way before all of this. And you're 23 years old. You are a BDR, which is crazy to have that. You've seen the whole thing. Fly back to that time period, you know, Sean Marshall at 23 years old, and walk us through this story that had a big impact on, you know, how you look at building companies and sales and marketing as a whole.
Sure. I mean, so my first job out of college was not in sales. I was a consultant at Oracle. I didn't know what the hell I wanted to do. I went to college thinking I was going to be a software engineer. So my first, I think 2 years in college, I was in computer information systems and, you know, I really liked tech. I really liked software and I thought I wanted to actually be an engineer. I realized about halfway through that I didn't want to be an engineer, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't want to sit behind a desk and be coding all day. So I talked to my dad a lot about potential career paths, and consulting came up as one option because he happened to be a consultant at Oracle back in the 80s, early 80s, when Oracle was really small. That's why I went to Oracle. I mean, that's why I did what I did. So I did that for about a year and I was traveling everywhere and I was helping these companies that bought Oracle implement Oracle software. Just wasn't that gratifying. And I wasn't really motivated by the people I was, you know, working with. So I decided like two things. One, didn't necessarily want to work at a massive company like that. I just didn't feel valued, recognized, challenged. Like I just didn't feel like I fit in that type of world. And I also knew that I didn't want to be a consultant. I felt like I was super competitive. I worked my ass off. What can I do where if I work my ass off, I'll make a lot of money? Sales, right? I just sort of stumbled into going through that exercise. Like I just stumbled into sales. And so then the question was like, how do I get a job in sales? Everyone I talked to said, well, you got to start doing this type of work. You got to make calls. And so back then, I don't know if they called it BDR. I think I was a lead generation rep. That's what they called it. And you know, what we did is we basically made 120-ish cold calls a day and also had to send, I don't know, 30, 40 emails a day. So it was kind of this mind-numbing job. But what I liked about it is I definitely learned how to handle rejection. I learned how to think of my feet, and I learned how to tell a story. And that got me excited about sales. So I did the BDR thing probably for too long. I was a BDR there for like 2.5 years. And I learned a lot, but I probably stuck in it for a little too long. But the experience that really hit me, I think, and this is what you're referring to, was I got asked to shadow one of our best field AEs at the time. And we went to a meeting in, I think it was in Omaha, Nebraska. And I forget the company that we're going to meet. There's not a ton out there, but you know,
it's probably like six.
Yeah. I had never, I never like seen like the whole BDR role was like, do all this work, get a meeting, throw it over the fence, and then hope for the best. Mm-hmm. And you would hear some anecdotal stuff from the reps when you caught up during the week about how the meetings went, are they going to buy, all that stuff. But like after the meeting was set, it was just a black hole. And I'm like, I need to learn that if I'm actually going to go sell. Like I can learn the pitch and learn the product, but I need to know how to navigate these big companies because I know that that's really difficult. And we were selling to massive companies, like big Fortune 500 companies. So he invites me to the meeting. I didn't really have any expectations. I didn't know what to do, how to carry myself. I didn't even know how to introduce myself. I was super nervous. And so long story short, like that meeting basically was comprised of like a VP of HR, a director of IT. I think there was a handful of other HR people. I think there was some people in security in the room. And I got to watch, it was probably a 2-hour conversation back and forth between all of these different people. And quickly got to realize that like getting a company of that size to do anything requires a lot of buy-in. And you can't be single-threaded. And you have to sell a lot of different people. Now, this is going to sound like table stakes to a lot of people, but like this meeting really made me appreciate the fact that if my rep does not convince this person over here that our product is not the right product for them at this time, this deal's dead. And the way that he's going to describe the value that we provide to this person over here is completely different. And watching him context switch, ask questions that are very relevant to that specific role, and come out of that meeting with like a plan. He basically, you know, created a sequence of events that would have to happen in order for us to get a deal done by whatever it was. It was like 6 months out. And seeing how that all came together, I'm like, not only is he super smart and really good at telling a story and presenting and asking questions and being curious, but like he's a really good project manager. He's basically herding a bunch of cats, setting up a sequence of events that need to happen, holding people accountable, and making sure all of this stuff happens at the right time. So the ultimate end goal will be they sign a piece of paper and wire us money. And to me, that was like, it was just way more than what my perception at that time was of sales. It was a very different, like sales wasn't the right word. I felt like it was a mixture of like consulting, sales, project management. It was just like really interesting. And I knew that if I was good at it and I worked my ass off, I could make a lot of money. So it felt like a perfect thing. So then I went on the journey of, you know, starting at the bottom and trying to figure out how to sell, and just went from there.
Does that AE that you shadowed still, is that how you triangulate excellence when you're hiring reps? Do you look for, you know, storytelling ability, great project managers? Is that kind of an archetype that you have since, you know, hired probably hundreds of now?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Everybody asks, like, how do you evaluate an AE in a 30, 60 minute meeting? Like, what do you ask? How do you really figure out like who's good and who's mediocre? Everyone has their own style, their own framework. I look for like two things, and I don't think these are like incredibly unique, but I'm trying to figure out if that person is naturally curious, like if they're wired that way. Because what I've realized is I can teach people what questions to ask and teach you how to probe for information to a certain extent, but I can't like teach you to be curious. You know, for instance, like I'm just wired that way. I ask questions just because I want to know, I want to peel the onion back a little more. What, it doesn't matter if it has to do with, you know, my work or my personal life. I ask a lot of questions. My wife would probably say it's super annoying. And that's just like how I'm wired. She's not wired that way at all. That, in my opinion, is required to be a good software sales rep, probably a good sales rep in any industry. You can get away if you're selling a very transactional type product with a 2-week, 3-week sales cycle, you can get away with learning the pitch. I'm going to figure out how to get you to the finish line and just kind of slam it home. In enterprise, absolutely not. Even in like mid-market, absolutely not. And so during the interview, I'm trying to understand, one, how did they prepare for that meeting with me? What do they know about me? That's a question I ask a lot. And typically what I find is there's like two different types of people. There's people that read me my LinkedIn profile because they didn't prepare, and I stop them right there and I say, don't read it. I already know what I did for work. What else do you know? And a lot of people just stop there. They're like, I know your VP of sales. I know you. This is what you do. And that's it. Not going to be a fit because you're selling me right now on why you should join my company. Other people will be like, I know you have 3 kids. You know, I know you like going to the beach. I know you like fishing. I know you like this type of food. Do you want me to keep going? And I'm like, yep, give me more. They're like, well, I know this. So I can tell those people used all the resources around them, either people that I work with that work for me or people we're mutually connected to figure out what makes this guy tick. Like, who is this person? What's he all about? Those are the people that I want to hire. And because not because they're going to make small talk, just because there might be something in those answers that gives them a little bit of a leg up and creates like a memorable experience, a memorable interview where I'm like, I'm going to remember that person.
There's just no excuse not to do that in this age of information, of podcasts. You can be like, you know, I know you did, you were on the GTM podcast and behind you, you know, there was this artwork of this little fishing village and here's the artist that I found with a quick Google search. And like, you know, you can bring up all of this stuff. And it is about creating that memorable experience. We were talking about this before we hit record too, was you got to make it memorable and then make the experience itself valuable. So if it's an interview, it's a product meeting, can you make that standalone valuable? Like, forget your product, forget what you're trying to sell, bring enough to the table that you leave the interviewer or the prospect going, wow, like I would have paid for that meeting because I learned XYZ.
Yeah, I think being being curious certainly helps because you're going to get a lot of information out of them. But also, like, how does a candidate just tell a story? Simple questions like, talk to me about your career. You know, just talk to me about your career. How they answer that question usually is indicative of like how they're going to actually tell like any story. And you know, it's a skill. I think it can be learned, but it's a skill. And we at Klaviyo, we wanted to hire people that, of course, were passionate about what we did in our product, but we're naturally curious and we're able to tell an effective story. And I think when you're selling a product that in a noisy market, whether it's a noisy market or you're trying to enter a new market where no one really understands this thing, like what you're doing, you have to be able to level up and like get them to think differently, which requires effective storytelling.
What have you found makes an effective storyteller?
I'll be very specific. Somebody, like if I'm asking somebody that works at Klaviyo and I'm asking them to get really good at speaking to an executive and tell a story about how they should change their marketing strategy, irrespective of our product, it's getting them to realize that like there's an underlying shift going on in the world. So zoom way out. There's a shift going on in the world. We believe the market's headed this way. Here are the underlying things that are happening causing this shift. And then this is what the future is going to look like. So it's like being able to connect the dots between like the current and future state, and then eventually relate that back to, in our world, your software, your product, and not feel that urge to get sucked into the weeds right away. Because I feel like what a lot of people do is they revert back to what they're comfortable with, which is like, I know what my product does. I can tell you what I can just go in and I can show it to you. I can talk to you about it. But being able to like park the product for a minute and really think about what that specific company, that industry, that the person you're talking to, what they're going to face over the next 5 years, irrespective of the damn product you're selling, and try to get them to understand or see the world the way that you see it. And then eventually you're going to map it back to what products will fill that gap and get you to that future state. But doing that is really, it's difficult. It requires you to like understand their world. So do your homework and really understand who they are personally, but like what the company is, challenges the company face, all that. And then what's happening in the market that's going to, you know, create this future state that you're talking about, and why are they going to feel left behind if they don't get on board? I mean, that's a simplified version of how we thought about it at Klaviyo.
I think it's great. That reminds me of, have you ever seen it's old now, but it's still timeless, Andy Raskin's greatest sales deck ever made. I think that's still such a perfect way.
That's the framework that I use for every single company I work with. The Zora deck, you know, everyone's going to talk about like having a challenger mindset and challenger sale and that framework. To me, that's just like the natural way to convey an idea and try to be persuasive. It's like you have to put a stake in the ground. You have to have a strong point of view. And then you want to be very prescriptive and confident in what that future state is going to look like and why you're uniquely qualified to get them there. So yeah, I love that framework. I use it. I mean, I was on two calls today where I didn't explicitly talk about that deck, but like that is the framework that I've sort of like adapted everything to.
Well, we'll make sure we put that in the show notes. Any enterprise seller or leader that hasn't seen that, it's great. I reference it all the time. Yeah. And I think the other thing too is, you know, the ability to tell us a story and then also comfortable commanding a room, because just like it's very easy or comfortable for a rep to slip into feature functionality because that feels nice and cozy. And I know they're same with the buyers, right? They are used to that and they think that they just want to tick off their check boxes and whatever kind of RFP they're running or whatever internal process. So they'll try and push you there too. And I feel like the best reps find a way to command the conversation and steer it back into, you know, this is a vision for the future of the company, not this one business unit that we're trying to deal with right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a very, very difficult thing to do. It's hot, like striking that balance between giving them what they're asking for, what they want, versus giving them what you think they need, what they need to hear. You know, I'll be honest, I don't have a framework for that. I don't think there's a silver bullet for that. It's a lot of it for me, at least, is based on gut and intuition. It's like, you got to be able to read the room, read people and understand these signs, but it's difficult, you know, and I think a lot of sales reps struggle with that and they're trained to operate a certain way. And they're so, I'd say like they try to hold information back when sometimes the right answer is just give it to them. Right? Just give them what they need. Like there's other ways to get to the finish line and still deliver a good experience for that prospect. But sometimes you just have to like answer their question, you know, and that is really, that's a tough thing to learn.
That's the art part. There's art and science, and that's definitely the art part. Yeah. You can frustrate the shit out of an enterprise buyer if you're just skirting every question and you're like, no, let's talk about the vision. That's awesome. Okay. I want to move quickly to a founder question. I love this part of the podcast. And this is a admittedly big question. So we probably could have spent the entire time talking through this one, but would love your take on it. So the question is, in past years, we relied on onboarding new reps to accelerate growth. We no longer have that luxury. How can we build a more efficient sales engine? So the classic struggle of, hey, we've got no more money to hire new reps. We now have to look at our current process and optimize for efficiency. What are the first things that come to mind when you look at creating a more efficient sales engine?
Yeah, so the word efficient means different things to different people. At Klaviyo, we always looked at our CAC payback, and we had a number in mind that we wanted to keep that below. And for the first, you know, 2-3 years, we had an insanely efficient sales and marketing engine. Some people would say, hey, you didn't invest enough, like spend more. And then we dialed it back a little bit, but we were always focused on that metric. So efficiency means different things to different people, but assuming it's CAC payback, because that kind of captures like all sales and marketing costs, I think that's a great indicator for how healthy is this machine. There's a few things that you can do. You can either drive more demand and your funnel stays the same, so you get more revenue. You can improve different points of your funnel, and you're going to have multiple funnels. You should have multiple funnels. You should have funnels for each product you sell. Even if you have one product, you should have funnels by customer segment and by geography. You know, or you can do what a lot of companies do and just raise quotas, which usually isn't the answer. So I'd say like the one thing that I would focus on, if just generating more demand magically was out of the question, which it usually is, there's small incremental things you can do on outbound or maybe through with your marketing content to you know, drive a little more traffic. But usually if you're very, very, you know, if you scrutinize all of your funnels and you look at each conversion step, at least in our case, we found a couple points that just were not like up to our standard. And we typically didn't spend time there because everything else was so good. You know, so the good times, everything's up and to the right. You don't get into the weeds like this. You're focused more on other things. But when you have to think this way and you're squeezing every dollar, this is, you know, we certainly went here, and this is what where I would advise most people to go. Look at different parts of your funnel. And usually if you break it down and understand exactly what makes that, like how the sausage is made in the funnel, and scrutinize every step and really get good at like understanding what's the story reps are telling at this point? What are they doing from stage 3 to 4? Is it consistent across the whole company? Is it consistent across like all reps? Usually you can grab a few incremental points on conversion. It's not going to, you know, you're not going to grab tens of millions of dollars in incremental ARR, but you know, if you optimize a few parts of your different funnels, usually there's gold to be had there. Like there's usually some incremental dollars there. We had a, you know, this is sort of like a going off on a tangent a little bit here, but I think it's important. We at Klaviyo, especially in the beginning, always looked at, before most companies were talking about capital efficiency, you know, and everyone was thinking about like grow, 2018, 2019, even into 2020. We always looked at, can we get a little bit more out of the team that we have before we go hire another human? We built a model that actually said, we didn't have a buffer in our model where we had 20, 30% quota coverage. Meaning like if some people miss, we'll still make our number. It was actually the inverse. We built a model and a sales headcount plan where if everybody hit, we like would barely get to our number. We may not even make our number. So it required multiple people in the org to greatly exceed their number. The beauty of that, if you have conviction on your funnel and you have good product market fit and you know how to drive demand, you can usually squeeze more out of your existing employees, and it's a win-win. So we opted to raise quotas a little bit because the trade-off there was, if we do this, we don't have to go hire more salespeople. It's more efficient. You're going to make more money, and it's great for the business. It's good for you guys too. But you have to really understand the capacity of every person. Like, what can that AE actually do? If there was no constraint on demand, how much business could that AE effectively close in 1 month and 1 quarter without feeling underwater, you know? And then do we have conviction across our funnel? And if the answer is yes, like I would advise, go back to your quotas and ask yourself, like, are they the right quotas? Like, can you move the numbers around a little bit without hiring more people? But you have to make a dent in other places for that to work. You have to, you know, optimize parts of your funnel. You might have to drive a little bit more demand in certain areas, but we would always go there before looking to hire more people.
I don't know if you've widely shared that, but that's a super interesting thing to know. And leaders who are building their plans, where traditionally it's baked in that 20-30%, you know, completely missed their number. And I know for me, if I was thinking of joining a system, I would take the slightly higher quota, but knowing we've set up a system where we want 100% of you to hit your number. And we're not baking in that 20-30% of you aren't, you know, that feels like someone that has your back, even though they're going to push you a little bit harder, but it's on them to also help with the demand. I'll push you a little bit on just any numbers for, and I know it's hard because you probably broke it down by like segment and geo, but CAC payback ratio, what was it sitting at when you felt like, okay, this is really healthy? Any guidance there?
It depends where you sell. So everybody will give you a different answer. And I do think it's unique to each company. I think it's good to have like a guideline that you're following, given where you tend to sell your product, if it's enterprise or mid-market or SMB. But early on, like we wanted to be well below six. We wanted to be below 6 months, you know, and that's not just sales payback. That's fully loaded payback. You know, I think if you're in the enterprise, if you're anywhere near 18 months, you're in good shape. On average, I think if you're around 12, you know, you're still in good shape. But there's so many other factors that matter. It's not like a end-all be-all metric, but it was something that we looked at every single month. You know, we'd create a plan with the idea that we're going to stay below a certain number, but then every month we'd close a certain amount of business, we'd hire a certain amount of people, we'd look back and say, okay, what was it? Like, do we have to course correct? So we were very, very diligent about like doing an audit every single month against our annual plan and looking at every different cut of the business to ask ourselves, like, did it play out the way that we assumed it would? And if it didn't, what happened? Should we change the rest of the plan for the rest of the year? Did we learn something? You know, so it wasn't a set it and forget it and then check it like at the end of the year. It was every month we were looking at it.
Well, learning more about the story, it is kind of, it was written that Klaviyo was going to be a success. I think it's a perfect example of how to build a modern SaaS company. Like everything you're saying is just so data driven, obviously like nuanced, but yeah, I mean, I could probably talk to you for another 2 hours, but we're running up against time and I want to ask you two final questions before we wrap up. And thanks for being so candid and sharing your personal story as well as the story of Klaviyo. This question I ask everyone, you can take it wherever you want. It's intentionally vague. What is one widely held belief that revenue leaders have today that you think is bullshit or just no longer serving us?
I would say that, and this is coming out of my experience at Klaviyo, in pre-Klaviyo, I would have thought this as well. The tactics that you use in SMB focus on building products at scale, over-indexing towards UX and UI, having a PLG motion behind the scenes, leading with your product, and also adapting the way that you price and package, meaning giving some optionality, some like month to month versus enterprise, like enterprises typically commit to a contract. I think there's this underlying belief that like that shit doesn't work in the enterprise. It does. Like it absolutely does. What works in every segment is giving customers optionality, allowing them to buy how they're comfortable buying. And a lot of people are going to disagree with that because it's actually really, really difficult to do in practice. And for if you're not adapting, you know, your internal policies like to this new world, it can create some issues down the line. But giving customers optionality and allowing these big companies, if they choose, to go month to month or to sign a contract if they want to commit. Leading with that optionality just like exudes confidence. And it's basically like we can back it up with our product. And our whole story was the reason these other vendors don't allow you to do that is because their products are a pain in the ass to set up. They're going to take months to get to value. And if they fuck up and they screw up in like month three or four, they have 9 months to fix it. Like you're on the hook. With us, you can fire us 12 times a year. It's up to you. People would be like, so what's the catch? We're like, there is no catch. Like we just have a lot of faith in our product and we want to show it to you. And so when you lead with that, it's just a very, very different experience. And it creates this sort of vibe where they're like, okay, like, why wouldn't I do this? Like, what's the catch? Like, everyone's just kind of like, why wouldn't I do it? And you quickly realize, like, people are willing to try new things and they want to give it a shot because you're making it easy, but you still got to deal with security and legal and some of that stuff, maybe behind the scenes. But getting them over the hump of like even thinking of trying it when they already use a Salesforce or something, it just changes the conversation.
Yeah. Just de-risks their, like, why not at that point? Why not? Let's give them a shot and they can win it or lose it. And I think that also only works because of these systems you were running at Klaviyo with these teams where you're like, hey, here's your CSM and you're already in lockstep. You're already creating that future for them. And so by the time, you know, they're in month one, they're almost like hitting the ground running already because you've done all that upfront work for them. Final question, similar question, but flipped in a more positive light. I know you talk to a lot of, you know, startups, high growth companies. What's one tactic or strategy that's working today for your portfolio companies?
I think this is like an underappreciated tactic, but it's so simple. And especially when you're in this like customer discovery phase, when you're like an early pre-seed stage type company and trying to navigate towards product market fit. When you get somebody to the finish line and they're excited, they're willing to use your product, they're either paying or not paying, but either way, like they're using your product and they like it, capturing that moment and like asking them for referrals, just trying to get at least one referral out of them, hopefully more than one. I talk about it a lot, but I don't see a lot of people doing it in practice because I think they're either apprehensive about like if their product's going to continue to give this customer value or if it's going to even work for them. And I think that's like an opportune time to just jump on it right there and try to get referrals out of them. And it's something that you can use, you know, if you're an established $20 million ARR SaaS company as well. It's like when you get them at that peak moment, they're super excited, they've chosen you, they're willing to get going and they've signed a contract, ask them for introductions, you know, try to get introductions out of that person.
Huge, huge. And something I look back at my career, I wish I did more of now being on the other side and like running some fundraising processes. It's like, that's the only way.
Totally.
The only way you can get new investors is through a referral, someone you've built trust with. It's the only way it gets done. And having that and understanding that now, same people are people. And so the same thing is happening with our buyers. So like the power of a warm referral is going to accelerate trust by a magnitude of like 10.
Especially if you're selling vertical software, because these ecosystems are tight knit. They talk to each other. It was certainly the case in e-commerce. I'm working with a handful of companies now that are vertical software, very specific industry. And these buyers collaborate, they network, they go to events, they talk to each other. If you want to drive word of mouth, you got to figure out how to create these network effects. And one of the ways to do it is get introductions from your customers.
Yeah, good call out on the vertical. Even more impactful there. They don't want to talk to, especially in some non-sexy verticals, they don't want to talk to Mr. Software guy or gal. They want to know from their trusted peer that they've done, you know, 15 years of work and partnerships with, you know, that's who they're trusting. I love it. Well, Sean, thank you for the time, man. That was awesome. So much good stuff in there. And congrats again on, you know, the historic runs multiple times, and lucky to have you in the community on the podcast. If people want to follow along with what you're doing, are you LinkedIn guy, Twitter guy?
I'm on both. Yeah. Probably not as active as I should be, but yeah, they can follow me, connect with me on LinkedIn or follow me on Twitter.
Awesome. Well, thanks again. And for all those listeners, thank you for joining us. Listening's one thing, you know, executing something totally different. Hopefully you can apply some of these lessons and help scale your business, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks a lot. See ya.